Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Lamont, do you have any introductory comments?
Not particularly, Mr. Chair. Just to note that we will first hear from the Public Defense Services Commission and then from the Judicial Department and then finally from the District Attorneys and their deputies.
Thank you. I will call forward the testifiers from the Public Defense Services Commission. Mr. Ellis and Ms. Swenson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Barnes Ellis, and I'm the chair of the Public Defense Services Commission, a commission that was established by the legislature in 2001. And we're very happy to have this chance to meet with you on an information basis. What we propose to do, I'll give a little background on the commission, its purposes, how it's organized, and then our executive director, Ingrid Swenson, we'll talk to you about some of our current initiatives. Now, in 1999, the legislature formed a study commission, which was assigned the task of studying the state's then method of providing indigent defense services and to make recommendations for improvement. I was privileged to serve as chair of that commission. Senator Brown was one of our members, along with Chief Justice Carson and Court of Appeals Judge David Brewer and nine others. The result of that group's work was Senate Bill 145, which the 2001 Legislative Assembly passed and which created the commission. The commission consists of seven voting members appointed by the Chief Justice, and the Chief Justice is himself an ex officio non-voting member. Commission members all serve without compensation. In addition to myself, the commission currently includes three lawyers and three non-lawyers. The lawyers include Sean McCray, who's the leading criminal defense lawyer from Eugene, James Brown, who's a former attorney general of the state and a former district attorney, and Chip Lazenby, whom many of you know, who was formerly legal counsel to Governor Kitzhaber and is currently a counsel to Portland State University. The three non-lawyers include Janet Stevens, who is an executive of the Bend Bulletin and a former public member of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, Mike Greenfield, who's a former director of DAS and with substantial experience in state government, and John Potter, who is the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The commission meets in open public meetings about 10 times each year. Many of our meetings are held in regions around the state with a view to getting out in the community and meeting with the diverse communities we serve. So in the last 2 years, we've had meetings in Klamath Falls, Astoria, Hood River, Eugene, Corvallis, McMinnville, Portland, and several meetings in Bend, all in addition to the majority of our meetings, which are held here in Salem. Now, let me give a brief history of indigent defense services leading up to the commission. It's clear the 6th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution all provide that a person charged with crime has a right to be represented by counsel. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the U.S. Supreme Court and the Oregon Supreme Court determined that this right also meant that persons without means to hire a lawyer must be provided counsel at state expense where there is a risk of incarceration. And the leading U.S. Supreme Court case, of course, is Gideon against Wainwright, which was decided in 1963. And you may be interested to know, when that case was before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Oregon Attorney General filed two Friends of the Court briefs, one with other AGs and one on his own, urging a broad interpretation of the right to counsel and pointing out that Oregon already was providing that in all criminal appellate cases and in all felony cases. Now, the logic of those decisions was compelling. Ours is an adversary system of justice, and we believe that both finding a fact and interpreting the law will best occur if both sides, prosecution and defense, have the resources to present their side of the issue so that a neutral court and a jury can fairly determine the facts and apply the law. Now, as we all learned in the difficult year of 2003, which is just two sessions ago, adequate provision of defense for indigents is an essential component of our criminal justice system. In that year, when the state's economy tanked and funding for indigent defense came up short, the Chief Justice was required to simply embargo the processing of whole categories of criminal cases. That was truly bad from the standpoint of public safety. And all of the components of the criminal justice system, police, prosecutors, corrections, and victims, recognized that without adequate defense funding, the entire system simply cannot function. We had a remarkable hearing that year in front of the Ways and Means Committee where representatives of all those other components of the criminal justice system spoke in favor of strengthening defense funding. Now, interestingly, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided Gideon and the Oregon Supreme Court similar cases, they wrote lengthy opinions about the requirement of providing counsel, but they said nothing about how those services would be funded. Now, prior to 1983, that burden fell on the 36 Oregon counties. In 1981, the legislature enacted a major restructuring of the Oregon court system, including making the Chief Justice truly a statewide administrator of a unified court system. And in that same bill, effective in 2 years later in 1983, the state assumed financial responsibility for the operation of the court system, including indigent defense, which was the most rapidly growing segment. Now, for most of the years from that time until the commission was created in 2001, these services were procured through the state court administrator's office. But there was very little opportunity for planning and managing a cost-efficient and consistent quality system. Now, the commission, which was formed in 2001, became responsible for provision of appellate services right away. And then in 2003, we became responsible for provision of trial-level services. The appellate services today are provided by a staff of 36 full-time attorneys in our legal services division, headed by Peter Gartland, and we do contract out some of the appellate work as well. The trial-level services are provided largely through, contract-based system. It was one of the findings of the study commission that Senator Brown and I were on that we think it's important that trial-level services be provided by providers that are in the communities that that they serve. Now, we work with a number of different types of providers. About 35% of the trial-level services that we contract for are through nonprofit community defense providers. And these are entities whose lawyers are full-time providers. They're full-salaried providers within those agencies. The largest of these are Metropolitan Public Defenders, and that operates in both Multnomah and Washington County. Multnomah Defenders, which operates in Portland. Lane County Public Defenders in Eugene. And then there are seven other smaller of these community providers around the state. And you may be interested to know a new one is now being formed here in Marion County. And we also contract with a number of consortium groups. This is where independent attorneys form a common management structure and contract either for a set number of cases or contract on an hourly fee basis. Then, in addition, we contract with some lawyers and some law firms. In some areas, the services are provided through an appointment system, And we just recently restructured that in Lane County to have an administration that is accountable there to a community-based board. We currently have 95 providers under contract. The contracts are negotiated and managed by our Contract and Business Services Division, which is headed up by Catherine Aylward, and they have 19 and a quarter full-time employees there. Now, the types of cases for which we are responsible include not only criminal, and criminal is about 63% or 64% of our budget, but it also includes juvenile dependency, juvenile delinquency, termination of parental rights, mental commitment, probation, and post-conviction cases. And I think a lot of people don't realize this, but 34% of our budget is for juvenile services. And in the last fiscal year, we provided representation of all types of cases for some 179,000 cases. Now, our first executive director was Peter Ozan, and I think many of you know or knew Peter. And after 4 years of really outstanding service at OPDS, Peter last fall accepted a position in Arizona. So we then conducted a nationwide search for a successor. We interviewed a number of very highly qualified applicants, and we were pleased that among these was Ingrid Swenson, who has a long history at all levels of defense services in Oregon, including being general counsel to OPDS. And we enthusiastically and unanimously selected her as our new executive director. And Ingrid, I will discuss with you some of the initiatives that we've taken and are currently working on to try to improve efficiency and to improve quality in the provision of these vital services. Ingrid.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Ingrid Swenson. I would like to talk to you about some of the major initiatives that both the Commission and the Office of Public Defense Services have undertaken for the purpose of improving the quality of the work that our providers provide, and also talk about the cost-effectiveness of some of those efforts. The most ambitious of the initiatives that the Commission has undertaken is this site visit process that Mr. Ellis has just described, the structural review of the public defense representation system in each and every county in order to determine whether it is the most cost-effective and is producing the high quality of public defense representation which we would like to see. The process starts with an initial investigation, which is conducted by the Office of Public Defense Services, and then the Commission holds a meeting or meetings in those jurisdictions, hears from the providers directly and from the local judges, from the prosecutors, from members of the entire juvenile and criminal public safety systems in those communities about what their needs are in terms of public defense and whether we're meeting them. And if we're not, whether those are structural issues that need to be addressed by the Commission or quality issues which need to be dealt with in some other fashion. As Barnes indicated, the Commission has met in a number of sites. They've reviewed 15 county systems to date and more than 24 public defense contractors, and that's approximately 57% of the caseload. So they're making good progress in terms of reviewing statewide system performance. In 2007, we have seven visits into seven county areas scheduled for them. These reviews have allowed the Commission to make structural changes where needed. As Barnes indicated, in at least one community, for example, we had a public defender office which provided the great majority of services in that county, and then there was a court appointment list which covered the balance of cases. And unfortunately, when the Commission arrived in the county, we were informed that nobody knew who was on that list, how you got on the list, and how you got removed from the list. So under those circumstances, it appeared that some kind of improvement in the structure and system for the selection of list attorneys was needed and was undertaken. In a second initiative, the Office of Public Defense Services has created a quality assurance system for reviewing the quality of representation provided by our private contractors. It's a very unusual system, unique as far as I know. I'm not aware of any similar system elsewhere in the United States. We organized a quality assurance task force of volunteer attorneys who got together and put together a plan for reviewing the quality of representation in various counties. They form site teams, which include both private practice retained attorneys and public defenders. These are volunteers who spend 2.5 days in the county talking to the judges again, to the district attorneys, to the law enforcement folks, parole and probation, juvenile department, Department of Human Services, all of the people who are part of those systems in order to determine whether those providers are providing high quality service, and if not, in what areas they need to be improved. We have a questionnaire system. We administer questionnaires to all of these folks. We gather all that, conduct all these interviews, and at the end of those 2.5 day visits, these lawyers meet with the contractor, talk about what they've heard, talk about what they've observed that is good practice and might be useful in other parts of the state, talk about places in which improvement is needed, and recommend ways in which that improvement can be accomplished. Some of our site team lawyers have even volunteered to mentor some of the attorneys when they have encountered significant problems in representation. That Quality Assurance Task Force, which oversees all of this process, also has compiled a list of best practices over the course of the evaluations that they've done. Those best practices have been published and shared with other providers. Among them are things, for example, like providing representation from the beginning of a case. Obviously, the client and the system as a whole benefits if the lawyer is there from the very beginning of the case instead of at some interval after the initiation of the case. So that's one of the best practices that's promoted among our providers. There are obstacles to providing representation at that initial hearing in some counties, which we're trying to help them overcome. That process started in the spring of 2004. To date, there have been 58 volunteers who served on 11 site teams. We reviewed the work of 26 contractors, and that's about 53% of the caseload. So once again, we're a little better than half, and we plan to do 5 more of those this year. The third initiative that I wanted to talk a little bit about today, but not in any length, is the juvenile dependency representation area. Senator Brown and others are certainly familiar with the fact that there are problems in the quality of representation in that area. Those issues were raised by the state bar in a report as early as 1996. The Juvenile Court Improvement Project of the Judicial Department has identified similar problems, and the Secretary of State has advised us that this is an area of vulnerability to us, the quality of representation in those cases. As one mechanism for trying to address that issue, the Office of Public Defense Services worked with the Juvenile Court Improvement Project, the bar, the University of Oregon Law School, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Juvenile Rights Project, and others to put together a juvenile law training academy, a nice name for a system which wanted to accomplish a couple of things, one of which was to outline a comprehensive curriculum for juvenile lawyers so that if you wanted to practice juvenile law in Oregon, you could undertake to complete this curriculum, and at the end of that should be well qualified to at least begin representation, quality representation in these cases. To date, we have conducted 2 trainings. They were both 2-day events. The first one was designed for a basic level understandings for beginning lawyers. We called it the Essentials of Juvenile Court Practice. And then this last fall, we did one for more advanced training in termination of parental rights. Thanks to all the support we got from all of these co-presenters, we could keep the cost extremely low so that that was not an obstacle to people participating. So we had good participation in both of those. And I have to say that there, none of these initiatives that I've been talking about could have occurred without significant volunteer participation from the commission members and our chair, who are volunteers, to the lawyers and the other people who work on these projects, including when we go to the communities, all the people who volunteer to give up their time and meet with us and talk with us and assist us in our process. I also would like to report just briefly that I think we're making good progress on our performance measures, and of course we talk about this in much more detail in our budget documents, which we'll be discussing with you throughout this process. Our appellate division has made significant progress in addressing the backlog of appellate cases, despite a dramatically increased caseload due to a single Supreme Court case, which you are well familiar with, Senator Burdick. The Blakely case had a tremendous impact on appellate practice in the state. And our contract and business services division has continued to improve its operations so as to promote timely and accurate approval and payment of public defense expenses. We find, for example, that since most of our providers end up working at less than market rates, if we're able to pay them in a very prompt and timely fashion, they're willing to continue to work for us, even though they can get paid at higher rates working for others. All of that is to say that in the 3.5 years since it assumed responsibility for the entire public defense system, the commission has realized its potential as an effective statewide administrator of an integrated public defense system and has implemented policies and procedures designed to maximize quality and minimize the cost of Oregon's system for the delivery of public defense services. In the next several biennia, however, beginning with 2007 to 2009, there are some issues that must be addressed in order to allow the commission to continue to accomplish its mission. And I'd like to briefly talk about four of those before we finish our presentation here. The first is the limits of the caseload projection model that we have been using. We have discovered that the model that has been used for decades to project future public defense expenditures and develop the budget for public defense is flawed and needs to be replaced. Since assuming responsibility for the provision of public defense services in 2003, the commission has been able to project trial-level caseloads with a high degree of accuracy. Based on actual expenditures, however, in the first 10 months of the current biennium, we realized that we would be exceeding the funds that were appropriated by the in the 2005 to 2007 budget. And that was because the traditional caseload model for projecting the demand for cost and the cost of public defense services underestimated certain necessary funding levels. And this was essentially because of three reasons. The first one was that, contrary to the assumption that underlies the caseload model, the number of criminal appeals was disproportionate to the number of trial-level cases. We had assumed that it would be roughly proportional. It was way out of proportion to the trial-level cases. Secondly, protracted litigation and appeals in death penalty cases from previous biennia continue to require funding from the current biennia. So although we have a limited number of new death penalty cases coming into the system, we must continue to fund cases that arose in previous biennia. Finally, some categories of costs, such as increases in professional fees for attorneys in some especially serious cases, for forensic experts in others, for mileage expenses, as well as rapidly increasing need for interpreters, have increased well beyond the state standard 2.4 inflationary adjustment rate. By replacing the caseload model with a projection system that accounts for these dynamics, we anticipate that we can provide you more accurate and reliable budget proposals in the future. We do need a supplemental appropriation, however, to complete the 2005 to 2007 biennium. How am I doing on time? Do I have 5 minutes more? All right, thank you. Second issue I'd like to bring to your attention is a projected shortage of private contractors to do trial-level public defense. The commission must basically advise this assembly that the supply of qualified lawyers willing to deliver public defense services in Oregon may no longer be sufficient to meet the state's demand for those services at the rates of compensation we have been able to pay in the past. A number of these contractors have advised us that they cannot continue their past practice of taking additional cases in order to receive additional funds. Some contractors take cases in numbers that significantly exceed national caseload standards. Many contractors have reported difficulty recruiting and retaining sufficient numbers of attorneys to handle the caseloads for which they have contracted. And in some areas, we anticipate that we will have difficulty finding any provider willing to enter into a contract at our current rates. The third issue is the need for an adjustment in our mandated caseload. Again, it appears that prior budgets have been built on a flawed assumption, leading the legislature to believe that it was providing adequate funds, but causing increasing pressure on these private providers whose costs were growing faster than was anticipated by our funding formula. In past biennia, the legislature has funded our mandated caseload costs through a formula that was based on this projected caseload growth, which we just talked about, and the standard DAS inflationary adjustment, which is well below the personal services adjustment. And most of the costs of our providers are personnel costs. So that has just not been sufficient to allow them to meet rising personnel costs. We also would be looking at requesting a mandated caseload adjustment with respect to our health services division. I know I'm short of time, and I would otherwise want to introduce at least our policy packages to you, but of course I'm hoping you will let us provide you information and testimony about those in the future. We've provided you an outline of our presentation this afternoon and copies of two documents. One is the qualification standards for court-appointed counsel. These are the qualification standards adopted by the commission, which are the minimal requirements if you want to provide public defender services in the state. And we also provided the Oregon State Bar's performance standards for lawyers in criminal, juvenile, and civil commitment cases. These apply to retained counsel as well as to appointed counsel, and they basically say this is what a lawyer should be doing for each and every client in this system. We look forward to providing you any additional information that would be useful, and I'm happy to answer any questions if we have time.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would appreciate your advice on whether this question is appropriate now or in some other way. In some cases, charges are consolidated to present cases that might run across jurisdictions might be consolidated for efficiency and for prosecution purposes. For example, the interest there is some interest being discussed in consolidating identity theft cases. And I'm sorry that I don't know all the jargon yet for how this will evolve. But if that happens, we understand the impact and the primary reasons for consolidating. But what impact might that have, if any, on defense costs for defense?
Do you want to make a quick comment about that?
I'd be happy to try, Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson. I think there are a couple of things to think about. One is there are obvious efficiencies when you consolidate cases, and that can help everybody conserve costs. When you move cases from the place they occurred, assuming that an event occurred in one jurisdiction and you're going to move the trial to another, there are potentially some additional costs that would be incurred if you undertake it at that stage. But if it occurred at the outset of the case, there could certainly be some economies there.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your caseload issue, I think, is really very crucial. The question I've been asking this committee is, if we approve state highway patrolmen in the number of 139 men and women, how is that going to affect the rollout cost. I mean, it's going to go through indigent defense. It's going to go through jails. It's going to go through prosecutors. It's going to go through judges. Do you guys have any way of figuring out how much that rollout cost is going to affect us? I mean, I you don't have to answer that now because we probably don't know it, but that's my concern with this whole thing is that we do one thing at one end, it's just going to roll right through the entire criminal system.
There is clearly a ripple effect when you pass a new statute creating a new crime, or when you add to enforcement, there's a ripple effect. It impacts the courts and it impacts defense. That's obvious.
Just one more question. Straighten up. Page 3, you indicate your public defense representation was provided in 179,000 cases in 2006. That's fiscal year 2006. Now, I hear you say you had 95 contracts out. Does that cover those whole 179,000? Or
the bulk of it's done through contract. Some of it's still done on an appointed basis. But, these are large providers that we're talking about, and they do contract for some of the very large numbers of cases.
I just did some quick math. That's 1,884 cases per contract. That's a lot. I mean, you do have a huge caseload, in other words.
The contracts are different sizes. I mean, like MPD in Multnomah and Washington, they would, I think they account for something like 12% of the whole state volume. So they're not all the same.
Sure. Just a thing.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You said that you've helped to promote timely payment. What would that be from the time somebody submits a bill that the contractors would get paid?
And it's part of our, it's one of our performance measures. Catherine Edward is here and can probably tell me off the top of her head, since this is her bailiwick.
Approximately 90% are paid within 10 business days.
Thank you. And we need to get moving on so that we have enough time for the judges and the district attorneys. But I do have one request for some information, Ms. Swenson, probably. In my district in Multnomah County, constituents have brought an issue to my attention, which is revolving around the city's exclusion zone ordinance, whereby police can give out tickets, probable cause, exclude somebody from a particular area, and then arrest the person when they return for criminal trespass. Concerns about that have been expressed to me, but from a budget viewpoint, I was hoping you could see if there's been an increase in misdemeanor services over the past 10 years or so as that has expanded.
Total, well, I can inquire further about the information one. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Next up, we have Judge Demunis. And Kingsley Click. Your Honor, when you're ready.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Demunis, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present an overview of our statewide justice system. Obviously, this is an overview. I can't cover every aspect of our court system, but I will try to indicate to you the challenges that we face in the 21st century and our strategic priorities for meeting those challenges. My remarks today will focus on three areas. First, I'll provide you with an overview of the day-to-day work of our courts at each level. Second, I want to talk about the role of the Office of the State Court Administrator. Kingsley Click is here. Third, I want to discuss the investments that we believe are necessary to ensure that the judicial branch of government can meet its constitutional obligations in the 21st century. As the administrative head of the Oregon Judicial Department, I'm pleased to report the judicial branch is producing timely and high-quality work, responsibly managing the public funds that are entrusted to us, and ensuring that all citizens have access to justice. In my remarks that follow, you'll be introduced to a judicial system that is strong, accountable, and innovative. It's a branch of government that is poised to take the administration of justice into the 21st century. But make no mistake about it. Poised is all that we are. The role that courts must play in our constitutional government is not the same today as it was a generation or even 15 years ago. The judicial system that we have today is not equipped to handle the pace, volume, or complexities of the issue that we, as a society, are beginning and will continue to face in the future. The Oregon Judicial Department as it exists today was created, as you heard from Chair Ellis, in 1983. Prior to that time, the district and circuit courts were funded by the counties. The state was only responsible for the salaries of the judges. I was interested to hear, I'll give you just a brief aside, I was one of those lawyers, that's how old I am, one of those very young lawyers in the system where you actually came to the courthouse at 8:30 in the morning and the judge looked out in the crowd and made his or her own decision about who should represent who. That's the way the system worked before we have the system we have today. And I was one of those lawyers standing in the back of the courtroom getting my first misdemeanor case some 30 years ago. All other costs, facilities, staff, and public defense were borne by the counties. When the state court system was created, the state took financial responsibility for all aspects of the state court system except the provision of county facilities. Those remain the responsibility of the counties today. The most recent change to the Oregon Judicial Department occurred in 2003 when the Public Defense Services Commission was created, removing indigent defense funding from OJD's budget. Presently, the Oregon Judicial Branch of Government comprises the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and 36 circuit courts in 27 judicial districts. I want to start by discussing each of the courts briefly, beginning with the circuit court level. In the 2005-06 fiscal year, 610,000 cases, from parking tickets to aggravated murder, were filed in Oregon circuit courts. During that period, Oregon's 173 circuit judges conducted more than 24,000 trials. Our constitutional democracy is founded in part on the principle that the judiciary is a co-equal and independent branch of government. Yet, in many important ways, the Oregon judiciary is also an interdependent branch of government. The legislative and the executive branches have been instrumental in supporting the court's efforts to protect children, to strengthen families, to enhance public safety, and to enforce economic and property rights. As each of you know in this room, the problems that society faces today do not fit neatly within the lines where one branch of government ends and another begins. Those complex issues demand interdisciplinary solutions. This afternoon, I'd like to highlight one of those interdisciplinary solutions for you, and that's the 46 treatment-oriented courts currently operating throughout the state. Drug treatment courts, juvenile drug courts, family dependency treatment courts, mental health courts, and DUII courts are all part of our circuit courts programs. These are designed to improve outcomes for people who are addicted to drugs or alcohol or who have mental health issues. These courts use collaborative, community-based problem-solving models to improve lives, reduce crime, and promote healthy communities. Without the commitment of our community-based partners, these courts would not exist or succeed. In July 2003, the Northwest Professional Consortium performed what has become a nationally recognized evaluation of the second drug court to be established in the United States, the Multnomah County STOP program. The study of Multnomah County's pioneering effort includes these findings. The Multnomah County Drug Court costs $1,442 less per participant than business as usual. That means in sentencing or imprisonment. And since its inception, the savings to taxpayers has exceeded $1.5 million. That kind of savings is currently being replicated in the 46 treatment courts throughout the state. Moreover, Judicial Department data show that recidivism is much lower for drug court graduates. We use a very strict measure of recidivism. No felony or misdemeanor charges or convictions at 1 year after drug court graduation. Drug court program graduates have an 11% statewide measure. For comparison, the three-year recidivism rate for the Department of Corrections, which measures only someone who's convicted of a felony, is over 30%. The treatment courts that I have described are not just the courts of the future, they're the courts of today, and they work. Let me turn now to the relationship between Oregon's business community and our circuit courts. It is both good business and sound public policy for the courts of this state to remain committed to the needs of the business sector for its fair, efficient, and expeditious means of resolving those disputes that businesses choose to litigate in a public forum. Our courts are transparent. They permit community involvement through trial by jury, and they establish, and this is very, very important for industry, they establish precedents for industry to use in shaping its business practices. In recognition of that need, and under the leadership of Presiding Judge Marianne Bearden, Lane County Circuit Court launched its first, quote, commercial court, close quote, in November 2006. Parties to cases in any circuit court in the state may apply to the presiding judge of Lane County to have their cases assigned to that pilot program. This court considers, among others, products liability cases, technology and intellectual property cases, securities transactions, mass torts, and other multi-party business and class action cases, complex construction, insurance, and professional liability cases. Once accepted into the program, a case is assigned to the direct supervision of a single judge experienced in complex litigation. Experience in other states shows that an increased level of judicial expertise and the focused management of complex commercial cases both enhances the party's ability to evaluate a case based on objective business considerations and promotes the prompt resolution of that litigation. I want to conclude the overview of the work of the circuit courts by acknowledging the significant role that our citizens play in Oregon's judicial system. The courts of this state belong to all Oregonians. Nowhere is that ownership interest better demonstrated than in the nearly 1 million hours that citizens give to our court system each year. Their efforts help to preserve justice and promote the rule of law in our society. In the past year, Oregon citizens served nearly 200,000 jury service days. Citizen Review Board volunteers gave 75,000 hours and reviewed the case plans of more than 8,000 children in foster care. Let me turn now to the Oregon Tax Court. Very briefly, the Tax Court is led by Judge Henry Breithoff. It's only one of three tax courts in the country. The Tax Court is located here in Salem, and it handles cases involving Oregon's tax laws. In the magistrate division of the tax court, and we're very proud of this, it takes an average of only 7 months from the date of filing to the date of the magistrate's written decision. In the tax court, substantial numbers of those cases are litigated by people who represent themselves. And I'm very pleased to tell you that Judge Breithoff has undertaken many initiatives to make the tax appeal process transparent to citizens, user-friendly as possible, through a tax court website and the tax court's public outreach program. Oregon is one of 39 states that has an intermediate appellate court. Whether measured against the number of appeals taken by population or the number of appeals taken per judge, the Oregon Court of Appeals consistently ranks as one of the busiest and most highly respected intermediate appellate courts in the nation. Over the past decade, Court of Appeals has received on average 4,000 filings per year, or 400 cases per judge. Each judge on the Court of Appeals likely participates in the decision-making of more than 1,000 cases every year. In 2006, the Court of Appeals authored a record 420 written opinions. The Court of Appeals is truly the workhorse of the Oregon judicial system. Chief Judge Brewer is an inspired and forward-thinking leader of that court. Under his leadership, the Court of Appeals leads the nation in performance measurement. Over the last 2 years, he has sponsored a new appellate case management system, which I'm happy to report became live December 2006, on time and on budget. As Chief Justice, I'm honored to preside over the work of the Supreme Court. The primary work of our court is the discretionary review of the decisions of the Oregon Court of Appeals. In 2006, our court decided well over 1,200 petitions seeking review of a Court of Appeals decision. When I became Chief Justice in 2006, I initiated a comprehensive court-wide analysis of the work distribution among the justices and court staff. That initiative has committed the court to improving both the number of written opinions that the court issues and the time from filing to written decision. I'm pleased to report that in 2006, the Oregon Supreme Court issued 109 written opinions. That is 31 more than the court published in 2005 and more than in any year in the past decade. I'm also pleased to report that the court has been making steady improvement on its time to decision. Over the past 2 years, the court has been deciding most of its cases within 6 months, and in 2006 decided nearly 40% of its cases within 3 months from argument or submission. Like the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court holds some of its oral arguments at educational institutions across the state. Those court sessions have taken both courts as far east as Ontario and Nyssa. In my view, making this important aspect of the court's work more accessible to the public enhances Oregonians' understanding of the role that courts play in the administration of justice. Finally, for the first time in the court's 147-year history, two women, Justice Martha Walters and Justice Virginia Linder, are serving simultaneously on the Supreme Court bench. Already, in their brief tenure, they are making significant contributions to the work of the court. I now would like to talk briefly about the administrative functions of the state court system. The Office of the State Court Administrator provides the majority of the infrastructure functions for the court system and assists me in executing the administrative roles of the Chief Justice. The role of our state court administrator is to ensure that the judicial department prudently manages the department's resources, improves court operations, and enhances access to justice. As with other state entities, the Office of the State Court Administrator oversees central administrative functions, such as internal audit, budget, performance measurement, information technology, and education. It's more efficient to provide these functions in one location rather than replicated throughout the state. In addition, there are court-specific central functions that are unique to the Oregon Judicial Department. A few examples are court interpreters, the Citizens Review Board, model courts, and policy analysis. Central staff coordinate a set of standards for collection, verification of requests for court-appointed counsel, treatment courts, and advisory committees. You'll hear more about those functions in later budget hearings. As this brief overview indicates, Oregon courts at each level are fulfilling their constitutional role. However, we need the continued commitment of our partners in government to enable the judges and the staff of the Oregon Judicial Branch to carry our courts into the 21st century. Oregon no longer can afford to put off investing in its state court system. It's in this context that I would like to describe briefly my 2007-09 biennial budget request. In order for the Judicial Department to be adequately funded and move into the 21st century, the Judicial Department needs a total funds budget of $439.4 million total funds, $347.8 million of which are general funds. This number is approximately $26 million lower than I originally requested in my Chief Justice's recommended budget due to changes in how we propose to fund technology initiatives and other cost changes, such as the fact that Measure 40 failed. Of the $348 million general fund, $311 million is required to meet our existing workload. We are requesting new funding for judicial salaries, technology modernization, new judgeships, treatment support, court improvement and performance programs, interpreter rate increases, and a pilot program for real-time reporting for aggravated murder cases, court security improvements, and the restoration of the 90-year-old Supreme Court building. You will get those details later in our future budget hearings. First, some context on why these budget items are so important. You need to understand how OJD interacts with our partners in state government. Many of those agencies also appear before this committee. The courts are a reactive branch of government. Apropos the discussion we heard in the indigent defense presentation. We are mandated to adjudicate what presents itself at our doors within specific time frames established by law. We have no discretion to turn the public away. Here are some examples. Every person arrested by a state or local law enforcement entity must be arraigned in our courts within 48 hours. Before an inmate is sentenced to prison, the courts have to perform these functions. They have to arraign the person, they have to adjudicate the person, they have to sentence them, and they have to provide appellate review. In a foster care case, the court hears the case within 24 hours and then monitors the case through the Citizens Review Board and finally with a permanency hearing. In juvenile matters, the court adjudicates the case, fashions a disposition of the juvenile, and conducts appellate review. While every one of the policy option packages included in the OJD budget request are necessary to allow the courts to function in the 21st century, I want to spend just a few minutes focusing on my three top priorities. First, judicial compensation must be addressed. Judicial compensation in Oregon today is not commensurate with the important problem-solving and leadership role that judges perform in our communities every day. Oregon judges at all three levels are faced with these facts. They have not received an increase in compensation since 2002, not even a cost of living adjustment. They rank at the bottom for judicial compensation nationally. Oregon judges are now 50th out of 50 states. They earn less than innumerable other state employees. They earn less than many of the public lawyers who litigate in our courts, and they earn less than many young associates in Portland law firms. I cannot imagine that there's a single person in this room that's not embarrassed by the fact that Oregon judges are the worst paid in the country. The problem should be dealt with in two phases. First, circuit judges' compensation should be adjusted to at least $125,000 annually, and appellate judges' salaries adjusted by a similar percentage. That increase will adjust judicial compensation in Oregon to the average of the four surrounding states. In other words, when it comes to salary, we only want to be average. Second, it's clear that too often in our state's history, judges have endured long compensation droughts, forcing the judicial branch, like it must this time, to go to the legislature to seek unnecessarily large and sometimes perhaps politically unpopular catch-up increases. To the extent that judges have received increased compensation in the past, it has been enacted at the end of the legislative session without the kind of openness that the public has every right to expect. That pattern has not served anyone well. Oregonians deserve better, as do the hardworking public officials in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. The time is now to take the steps to change this process permanently and to institute a more responsible method for ensuring adequate official compensation. In that regard, I support legislation to establish a permanent mechanism for the quadrennial salary review of public official salaries in all three branches of government. In my view, establishing a neutral salary commission is clearly the best way to keep judicial and other public official compensation current and to minimize the perception that the process is influenced by politics. Judicial compensation is not a matter of judicial self-interest. Instead, it's a matter of attracting and retaining the most highly skilled and experienced lawyers from private law practice. In making that statement, I'm in good company. The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, just a couple of weeks ago, issued his State of the Court reports for the federal courts. He devoted his whole State of the Court reports to judicial compensation for federal judges. And I would just like to quote briefly from Chief Justice Roberts' comments. Our judiciary will not properly serve its constitutional role if it is restricted to, one, persons so wealthy that they can afford to be indifferent to the level of judicial compensation, or two, people for whom the judicial salary represents a pay increase. Do not get me wrong. There are very good judges in both of those categories. But a judiciary drawn more and more from only those categories will not be the sort of judiciary on which we have historically depended to protect the rule of law in this country. In Chief Justice Roberts' view, the issue of inadequate judicial pay has now reached the level of constitutional crisis at the federal level. How can it be anything less than that in Oregon, the state that in July of this year will pay its judges the lowest salaries of any state in the nation? The failure, in my view, to provide reasonable compensation for judges this session will threaten the competence and the efficiency of the judiciary and ultimately the public's confidence in the court's impartial enforcement of the rule of law. Our second budget priority this legislative session is the enhancement of our technological capabilities. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I just wanted to let you know we've got about 5 minutes so that we make sure we
I'm going to have to go really fast.
Yeah.
And I can do it.
Thank you very much.
Can I speak really fast?
Let
me go through this quickly. The past three decades have seen more change in the way courts operate in the entire century before. Technology has dramatically altered the way in which businesses, government, and individuals function. Our current case and financial management systems, commonly referred to as OGIN, these were built in the 1980s. They have only limited capability to provide data for managing programs, provide little opportunity for the public and other governmental entities to interact with us electronically, and are extremely difficult to upgrade to accommodate the changing demands of the work that we perform. Every time the laws change, and then those changes impact the way in which we function, it's very time-consuming, expensive, and risky to modify our existing systems. I have committed the judicial branch over the next 5 years to build what will become the largest and most accessible courthouse in Oregon, a statewide electronic courthouse, which we call eCourt. That courthouse will provide a common experience for all citizens of the state, no matter where they are located. It will be the place that a citizen may visit and do business with any court in the state at any time of day from anywhere in the world. Oregon's investment in eCourt will be significant, but the dividends that investment will pay will be innumerable, and the returns will continue well into the future. Our third budget priority is the need for additional judges. And let me just paraphrase to say this. Our growing dockets and the kind of cases that need the most judicial attention, okay, We have only addressed those with very conservative addition of judges in the past decade, and we need judicial resources now for those. We have, in November 2006, the Joint Committee of the Trial Court Judicial Resources has recommended the Legislative Assembly add 13 trial court positions across the state. Finally, if I got about 2 minutes left, okay, in those 2 minutes, I want to bring to your attention something that's not solely a Judicial Department item, and that is our Oregon court facility problem. You should have in front of you a report from the Task Force on Court Facilities, and I will let you take a look at that. But a quick roundup. In my view, the crisis calls out for a statewide systematic solution to keep the justice system functioning, and in several counties even to protect the lives and avoid catastrophe. And here's what I mean. A quick roundup of court facilities reveals one courthouse, our largest, that will crumble on several thousand citizens in even a modest earthquake. One courthouse that loses its heating several times each winter. One courthouse with no elevator for the elderly or disabled to reach the courtroom. One courthouse where the judge can hardly see the jury, and many courthouses that are so overcrowded that they cannot meet the demands of their growing populations. Our state capitol, where we are today, is a symbol of the executive and legislative branches of government. For the judicial branch, however, those symbols are not confined to a single building in Salem. Instead, the judicial branch of Oregon is symbolized in every county by a county courthouse that stands as a continuous assurance that justice is available to everyone throughout the state. The deteriorating condition of these buildings threaten the ability of courts to function. We need to develop a long-term statewide facility solution to this. And since my time is limited, let me just tell you that we had a task force that operated with the judicial branch, the bar, and the Association of Oregon Counties. You've been provided with that task force. We were pleased to have Senator Burdick and Representative Krieger work with us on that task force. It provides in that report a definition of the problem, a request for a systematic solution, and a requirement that we start to act now by establishing some dedicated funds to addressing this problem and a commission to prioritize and define our problem. Finally, I'll conclude with this. In the end, our constitutional democracy works because the other branches of government and the public are expected not only to acquiesce to judicial power, but to give it effect. To sustain that delicate balance of power in Oregon government, we must maintain the public's confidence in the competency, efficiency, and impartiality of our courts. To do so, I can assure you the Oregon judiciary is committed to prudently managing our resources, treating every litigant respectfully, issuing our decisions timely, and zealously protecting the public's access to impartial courts. And again, thank you for giving me this opportunity to be here and to provide this overview of our court system.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would ask the committee that if you have some questions that you can pass them on to Ms. Click or the administrator, and we can get the responses back to you so that I make sure that I give Mr. Foote his due time. Thank you very much for coming.
Very much. My pleasure.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairperson and members of the committee, subcommittee. My name is John Foote. I have the pleasure and privilege of serving as the district attorney here in Clackamas County. We're going to give you three pieces of paper or three documents to look at. I'm not going to talk about all of them today. One is a general outline of what I'm going to talk about, a two-page document. The second is our budget proposals, which I'm not going to go into the detail today. And then the third is a one-page graph that you may want to ask me questions about, because when I saw it, I had to ask questions too. So let me just...
Sorry,
The district attorneys are what I would call the third leg of whatever piece of furniture you want to choose of the criminal court system in Oregon. We, all three of those legs, you've heard from you already, support each other and collaborate with each other. And quite honestly, there's sort of a tension that makes it all work. And we need each other to function. The district attorneys, there are 36 in this state. They are independently elected in each county. They are statutorily created in terms of our responsibilities. They're also referred to in the Oregon Constitution. In essence, we have about 300 or more statutes that drive what we do. Most of it is criminal work, traditional stuff that you'd think, but we also do a variety of things that serve the public, such as collect child support. We have the deputy medical examiners in each county who are responsible for responding to scenes where people have died and handling the body and transporting the body to the medical examiner's office. And those are actually employees of our office by statute. We get public records requests and appeals. we do child dependency matters, which are not criminal. And that is how often they're done by us is a question of funding. We do aid and assist hearings, and obviously we do civil commitment hearings. And in some counties, the DAs are actually civil attorneys for the county. Larger counties like mine, that doesn't go on anymore. There are separate county council offices. We also have a lot of partnerships in addition to our traditional roles, and this is something that's happened more in recent years, but I think it's a really important part of what we do. We work on all sorts of work groups and commissions. We are on our public safety coordinating councils, a child multidisciplinary teams. We have a variety of community prosecution efforts in the state. We have interagency task forces in which we work with city, county, and state officials and agencies. And quite honestly, we're involved very much in trying to help the public understand what we do and how the system works and what they can expect from us. We are given a wide latitude of discretion on what we do, but with that comes a lot of responsibility to do it in a way that dispenses justice. So it's sort of a two-fisted problem. We have a lot of early disposition programs. I think Chief Justice was talking about specialty courts here. I think we have 7 in Clackamas County. And we are actively involved in either participating in those or creating them. So we see those as a real important function in what we do. We have about 360 deputies statewide in the 36 counties, but that is very unevenly broken by population and workload. Multnomah County has close to 100, I think somewhere between 90 and 100. My office has 28, but we have a number of offices around the state in which there is just one prosecutor, and that is the elected DA. We have 3 part-time district attorneys in the state. Part of our budget initiative is to change that, but that is traditionally, and they're listed here, Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler. We all have victim assistance programs. That's something that was actually started back, I think, in the late 1970s by the district attorney in Multnomah County, and most of us, if not all of us now, consider that an important part of what we do, and we collect child support. What are the challenges for us? Well, the biggest challenge is the traditional one, which is making sure what we do it well, and we produce a high quality of justice for the public. And quite honestly, that is a day-by-day responsibility in terms of supervision and training and assigning the right lawyers to the right kind of cases and trying to develop judgment in our lawyers as well as professional skill to try cases, because we negotiate over 90% of all the cases we handle, so judgment is a big part of what we do. Our caseloads vary widely, but they can be anywhere from over 200 to less, and it really depends on the jurisdiction but also on the kinds of crimes. In counties that specialize, like mine and Clackamas County and Multnomah County and Washington County, the caseloads vary depending on the kinds of cases. Child abuse cases and violent crime cases, you have to carry far fewer cases than if you're handling a lot of property crimes or drug cases where you can handle much larger volume. Because you have fewer private citizens as witnesses, you have more police officers who are used to testifying, your preparation time is less. The cases tend to be more straightforward factually, although not always legally. And we always have to balance the concerns of victims, which has become a very important voice in the system in the last 20 or 25 years, rightfully so, I believe, balance their interests and concerns with what the public expects from us and what the facts of the case are, which is always the primary thing that drives our work. What are the facts? As I said, our partnerships are a big part of what we do. Community prosecution, which was started in Multnomah County, we have one. People around the state, different counties have different programs. It's really all about trying to solve problems before they come in the system. We created a mental health court in Clackamas County about 2 years ago to try and deal with people who are committing low-end property crimes. But really their driving problem was not criminality, but it was their medication and a place to live. And so to use the court as a leverage for that. Traditionally, we have been a blend of funding, both county and state. As most of you know, that blending has changed a little bit over the years. I was interested, and I didn't know that in 1975 the percentage of state funding of the overall funding for DAs was 19%. And as you can see, in 2000, actually in 2000 it was down to 9%. And I was trying to figure out what it was in my county, and it's different in every county because if you have just one elected district attorney, the percentage of state funding is a lot higher. But in my county, I think it's 1%. So we've seen a decrease in the state funding of district attorneys, and quite honestly, the counties have stepped up and provided the funding in the gap for us. We also have facility challenges. We actually work in the same buildings that the court does. So the challenges you've heard described to you are the same ones that we've... Half of my office isn't in our courthouse. It's spread out in 5 satellite offices around Oregon City. I wanted to finish by talking about performance measures. We've selected 2. You can see what they are. This is a challenge for us. Because if you do the wrong performance measures, you can create the wrong incentives in your lawyers. For instance, the conviction rate. For the rate of trial. If your standard is the conviction rate, you can create an incentive for lawyers not to try cases that they should try or prosecute that might be difficult, but should be prosecuted or tried. So you have to be careful, and we're trying to be cautious about how we do that, but we're still working with staff to see if we can come up with some others, and we know we have some more work to do on that. So that concludes my remarks. I would like to thank you for an opportunity to talk to you, and I would be glad to answer any questions you have.
Questions for Mr. Puck? Senator Nelson?
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your chart is pretty interesting. There's another facet to that. You're talking about Department of Corrections. They've got a 30% increase. They probably have the largest budget. So 30% of a billion is a lot more than... And of course, you have a decrease, basically. In 20, you're down 3 or 4% of whatever it is. So, well, I appreciate this chart because it does give us a little sense. And you know, my concern always been is, okay, if we hire more state patrol folks, which looks like we're going in that direction, that's eventually going to end up in your office somewhere, right? Because it's just going to roll through the whole system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Nelson, excuse me. You're right. There is a short-term impact if you put more police officers on the street that you're going to probably see more cases in our office and in the courts, and you require more in defense. But I also think that in the long term, if it's done properly, that you can actually have a long-term impact to reduce crime. And, in fact, it's been done places before. There are examples that I'd be glad to talk to you about where you have to make the investment and realize the short-term impact is going to be more work, but the long-term impact can be more safety and fewer crimes.
That's a good perspective. I haven't thought about it.
But you have to do it right, or you may not get that payback.
A lot of what the troopers will do is prevent some crimes from happening just by their presence. Can I ask you a question, Mr. Foote? This chart, is this general fund and lottery funds, or is this total funds for these agencies? Do you have any idea?
Sure, I believe it is just general fund. Is that right, Ken?
Okay. And could you speculate on what was driving the increase? Well, we might have somebody else who could provide that answer. What's driving the increase in DOJ funding over that 97.99 to 99.1?
Yes. Kevin has the details, and I would be glad to have him answer that. Would you like to take a shot at it, Kevin? I don't want to get it wrong.
I will try, Mr. Chair. I don't have the background data, but at one time, and it was about this time period, the rate charged to state agencies subsidized the defense of criminal convictions, meaning that DHS was funding defense of criminal convictions in part. That was discontinued in 1901, if my history is right, which the former DOJ official is shaking his head yes. So it really does skew this chart a little bit by including that line in it, because the defense of criminal convictions now is all, or almost all, general fund funded, if not all. So I'd like to see the background data on this chart. But I think it still shows the declining percentage, or a smaller decrease for the DAs, which there is no doubt that that's the case.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. And do we have any announcements we need to make?
Other than tomorrow is the state police, public safety standards and training, and the military department. And then your overviews are done, and you'll actually start doing a few budgets or budget hearings next week.
And then don't forget, on Tuesday the 30th, we might go a half hour over from 3 to 5, and that'll be on incarceration trends. And this meeting is adjourned.